Today is the 7th of March 2019. I'm interviewing Peter Gerard Williams, formerly of Waipapa, Maitotara, and he's going to tell us something about his family since they came to New Zealand. Peter, you're on air.
Thanks, Frank. Now, basically, my family in New Zealand originated when Henry Williams came to New Zealand and resided up in Taihia in the 1830s. He was part of the Church of England, had been in the Royal Navy before that, and so very familiar with boats. So he found living in a place like Taihia, where everything was done by boat, he could handle all that. And he's notable really for writing or translating the Bible into Maori with the help of his two daughters, who spoke fluent Maori. So that was all done. He was actually shown on the old original 10-shilling note, Treaty of Waitangi. Chiefs and military and everybody else involved in signing sat around this table, and Henry Williams was the only one that didn't have a headgear on. So anyway, that was way back in 1840. And then since then, most of his family sort of moved down to the east coast, North Island, around the Gisborne area, north of Gisborne. In those days, it was sheep farming and wool developed the country. We've been involved in farming ever since. My father, Paul Williams, was the son of Dr. Jack Williams. He was one of the first pupils at Christ College. He used to sail all the way down from Taihia to Christ College and stayed at Christ College all the year. At the end of the year, he'd sail back up to Auckland and up to Taihia. And then he was sent off as a young student to university and England and became a doctor and a surgeon, and of course the horrors of being a surgeon in the First World War, and basically ended up back in Gisborne as a GP. He delivered myself and my twin sister Wendy, who's now Wendy Falloon. Our family consisted of Wendy and myself as twins, born in 1938, and then my sister Bobby, born in 1941. And then much later, my brother Gerard Williams, called Jerry, and he's 11 years younger than me. So during the war, my father was in the Navy during the war. Basically, we had a house rented at Wainui Beach, the Witter's house. We lived there for about 5 years during the war. And from a children's point of view, it was a wonderful place to be at the beach. Went to school, started school at Kaiti School in Gisborne. When the war finished, my father came back. Not a very well man, but he came back, and in 1947 we moved down and bought a small block of land we called Wainui after the beach, and that was between Puketap and Taradale. And funnily enough, when we were at Wainui Beach, my sister and I used to be told by my mother after lunch, go and sleep in the caravan, don't want to see you from lunch until 3 o'clock. Go in the caravan and read a book or stay there. The very next year, and we left, and there was a tidal wave, big earthquake. Tidal wave 1947, and that tidal wave picked this caravan up, took it out to sea, and it went. So we could have been there. So we're quite lucky. That tidal wave actually was a big one, and it went right up to Turihaua homestead, right up through pine trees, and nearly got to the homestead. It was really, really a big one. When I got to the new property near Taradale, you couldn't even see the hills for the rabbits. And there were black ones, white ones, piebald ones. And my father taught me to shoot with a 22. Well, the first rabbit I shot was from the hip. That pointed at the hill, pulled the trigger, and the bloody rabbit dropped dead.
There were that many of them.
There were so many of them. And then a lot of the guys back from the war had not much to do, and they used to go rabbit hunting, and they caught so many rabbits through strychnine poisoning. And then, of course, they kept the pelts. So a bit of old number 8 wire bent over, and they'd just skin a rabbit and put the pelt over a bit of number 8 wire, and you could drive along the road for a long way and just see dried out pelts sitting on the fence there. That was a bit of money in it, I suppose. And so that was my first farming experience. So I more or less brought up on the farm, riding horses. And my younger sister Bobby was a very good rider. We all rode horses in the pony club for a start, and basically went to school. I went to Heriworth in 1948. Having been going to Puketap School and riding a horse up there with my twin sister Wendy, then as we got a bit older, I went off to Heriworth for 4 years, and then to Christ College for 5 years, started Christ College in 1952 and left in 1956. And those were wonderful years, really. Made so many friends, North and South Island. Played a lot of sport, generally grew up, came home in the holidays and played tennis. And it was a great life, really, in good old sunny Hawke's Bay. What happened after school is the important thing. Okay. Connolly, the Minister of Defence for the Labour Party, announced that they were not going to have compulsory military training any longer, which went down like a lead balloon with all the young men. It was a wonderful thing. It taught everyone a bit of discipline, got everybody out of bed, and got them cracking. What a contrast to the year 2000, where half the young people are on the dole, they don't have to get out of bed and do anything. They just get looked after. Basically, that was a wonderful thing for the whole nation. And we were so nationalistically proud of being New Zealanders, flew the flag and take on all comers. But now it seems to be a different philosophy where no one cares about anything much. Such a shame. Anyway, so my father wanted to take my mother to England after I left school, and I promised that I would look after the farm for him, and my sister would look after the house. And that prior to that, I'd been overseas, and I came back from overseas just to do this, to look after my father's farm. So on St. Patrick's Day in 1961, I took off as a young fella, about 21, and took the Wanganella to Sydney, and had a job at the Sydney Show grooming bulls for an Australian breeder. And my best mate, Paul Thomas, was over there doing the same thing. And we were going to catch the ship to England. And basically, the bull breeder said, you can't leave this job until we've won all the prizes. And we were doing very well. And so he offered to pay us an airfare to get to Brisbane to catch the ship. So we won a few prizes there, got it put on an aeroplane, and I wouldn't know where we were going, but we ended up in Brisbane, overnight flight, got put on the ship, and had a wonderful trip to England. Took about a bit over a month. Overseas trip, for me, lasted about 18 months, about a year, England and Europe. I worked in a little town called Shipley in Bradford, in the wool combing company. Worked for about 3 or 4 months in that, just to get a bit of money going and a bit of interest going. The worst part about that was seeing the best New Zealand wool going down the same hole as the worst Australian and South American wool, just to make carpets cheaper. We were in a three-story department, sort of a building, where the top fellas were, well, they were from Northern England, and you couldn't really understand their accent. And the next ones down were Pakistanis, and the ones at the bottom floor were the Polish. And everybody hated everybody else. And we were warned not to fall down the hole, otherwise you never know what could have happened to you. I lived there for about 3 months in digs, and it was just like Coronation Street all over again. Got out of bed, it was dark, and the time we got home, it was dark, and I never saw the light of day, really. Had a good trip around Europe, largely with Paul Thomas, and basically that was all over when we all had to go home. And I took a trip back from England to New York, and spent a week in New York staying as a young man, nearly 22 years old, in a flat of 4 young ladies that were American girls. And basically I was famous because I could go and buy the alcohol and they weren't allowed to. They weren't old enough, you see. Yeah. And then took a train up to Boston and stayed with a man in the United States Navy who my father had met during the war. And he took me up to Cape Cod and spent a week there, really, doing all sorts of things. And then I flew to Chicago and spent about a week in Chicago at a university called Evanston, a Northwestern University in Evanston, about 30 miles north of Chicago. And then after the last night at this university, in which their university won a gridiron match against another university, I've never seen a party like it, and put on an aeroplane to go down to Phoenix, Arizona, stay down there, Sky Harbor Airport, and maybe 4 or 5 days around Phoenix, in which time I drove up in a bus to see the Grand Canyon. Absolutely brilliant trip through the United States for a whole month. Got to Los Angeles and then San Francisco, and then flew out to Hawaii on the way to Australia, hopefully to try and become a wealthy young man in the wheat harvesting business. But when I got to Sydney, it was just on Christmas time, and I met a stud stock consultant there, working for a firm called Goldsborough Mort, and this bloke called Andy Sprite, said, Peter, he said, I'll give you a job as a jackaroo on a cattle station, Western New South Wales. So get yourself to Mascot Airport, 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'll fly you out there with your suitcase. And if you like it, you can leave your suitcase there and stay. Otherwise, I'll fly you back, no charge. So I flew all the way out there, landed on this place, drove around in the first Toyota Land Cruiser I'd ever seen with the supervisor and Andy Sprite, and went down to the quarters and I said, just leave my bag there and I'm going to stay here. I stayed there for about 4 or 5 months, I guess, as a jackaroo, looking after the stud stock and riding horses and generally being a jackaroo. And then I finally came back home, and that was the time when my father said he wanted to take my mother to England, so I stayed and looked after his farm. I really wanted to go back to Australia and live, but I never got back. From there, basically, when father got back home, I went off down to Homewood Station as a farm cadet, really, and worked for Fred Tatham on Homewood Station, East Coast Wairarapa, for 2 years we were there, and that was a wonderful part of my life, being well looked after by the Tatham family, and learned a lot down there, had a lot of fun. Then I had to go out and do some work elsewhere. So I did. I went to Mungahani Station and spent 2 years at Mungahani, where Hugh Chisholm was the manager up there. It belonged to the Chambers family. And Dudley Chambers actually drove me up in his white international truck. And I was up there for 2 years. Hardly ever came home, but learnt a lot up there.
That's off the Taihape Road.
Yep. Mungahani is, well, closer to Taihape than what it is to Fern Hill.
Yes.
Quite a long way up. And so then farming was sort of coming to a situation where I wanted to be a farmer, but I wanted to own my block of land, and I wanted to learn a bit about ballot farms and how they ran, because that seemed to be my way of getting into a farm, a ballot farm. So basically, I noticed that a lot of the lands and survey properties suddenly went from about 60% to 100% lambing over a period of about 2 or 3 years. And we were astounded at all this. It wasn't just because the shepherds were good. It was mainly because they discovered selenium and cobalt. And so I left Mungahani and went to work for Lands and Survey on a big place between Rotorua and Taupo, and worked there for about a bit over a year and learned all about this. And then I came back to Hawke's Bay and I lived with my parents and used to drive my little Volkswagen up the road to Mosio Station, which the back end of it was bought by an Englishman called Henry Morris Jones. Now, all this time, of course, I was a young man and looking around, and I'd met Mary Lou Holden, and I knew the Holden family very well. They were friends of my family anyway. And basically, Mary Lou and I became friends, and then when I went overseas, she was still a schoolgirl. When I came back to work, she went overseas, and basically, we finally got together in 1964-65. And got married at the end of 1965, 14th of December 1965, actually, at Pokawa, in the Pokawa Church, and had a wonderful wedding at Mana, Pokawa, the home of her parents, and it was Ralph Holden and Mary Lou's mother, Phyllis, Jill and Dennis, Mary Lou's older brother and sister. I'd known the family for some time, but Mary Lou and I got together and got married then. It was a bit difficult because when I was up at Lands and Survey, they were pretty casual and they'd leave a young man like me all weekend with nothing much to do. So I joined the army again, having been in compulsory military training, and went into Papakura and passed the test to get into the Special Air Service. This is not regulars, this is the territorials, but they were a bunch of young men who were there to replace the regular SAS in Borneo at the time. They had a communist terrorist outfit trying to take over Malaysia, and basically our troops were up there. That was quite a big campaign, and we were there to replace anyone that got shot up, so we were pretty well trained, and I spent a lot of time going from Rotorua to Papakura in the Special Air Service, just training with them. However, that came to an end, and the campaign wound down, and I decided to get married, carry on with farming. So I was a young man working for Henry Morris Jones as his stock manager, and basically worked there. But Mary Lou and I, when we got married, we had a honeymoon up at Paihia, had a honeymoon on Urapokapoka Island, which is where Zane Grey used to have his fishing lodge way back in the 1920s. Lovely honeymoon. Came back and I worked with Henry Morris Jones, who very kindly built us a brand new Lockwood house. And, you know, we lived there for the first 3 or 4 months. But I was then offered the manager's job at Waipopo, which is up the Maraetoa. And so that's the next stage of my history, where in March 1966, Mary Lou and I went to live up there. Took over Waipopo, no staff on it, staff had all left. And so I was right into it. What a beautiful opportunity to get up there and make a start. So I used to have a little Volkswagen, but treated like a Ferguson tractor, really, with mud roof tyres on the back, because I can remember driving up the top of Waipopo in probably February. The grass was so long, it was higher than the roof of the car, and got out the top there and looked around from the top of Waipopo. You could see from Mahia Peninsula right down to Cape Turnagain. You can see Bear Island, and looking west, you can see from Manawatu Gorge right up to the hills of Bakawaro. And the Bakawaro was Whakapanaki. The right-hand side of it was where Tapuna Station was when my father was managing when I was born, before the war. And so you could see where I was born from up there, top of Waipopo. And my father used to look at Whakapanaki and say, "That's Whakapanaki where the ducks fly backwards," because of the strong winds. So 1966, up there managing Waipopo Station for two families. And one of them was a Williams family from London. These two young men, Simon and Ewan Williams, whose father had been killed in the Second World War. They'd never been to New Zealand. They just inherited half of Waipopo, which actually used to be part of Tiapiti Station. Basically, the other half was owned by four Mackay brothers, Commander Dennis Mackay, who was part of Royal Navy, and then three other brothers.
They all their names are Dennis, Colin, and Brian. Yeah.
The Mackay brothers, who owned the other half of Waipopo, Dad inherited Waipopo, which originally was part of Tiapiti.
How big was the central station there, Waipopo?
Oh, it must have been about 10,000 acres, yeah. I'll get back to the start of Tiapiti in a minute, but we'll go to Waipopo, and basically the Mackay brothers, apart from Dennis, who was Commander Dennis Mackay of the Royal Navy, they'd all been to Whanganui Collegiate, but the rest of them were orchardists down in Nelson, and so they had inherited this farm. They didn't know a great amount about farming, and so they used to consult me about, not the fact that I was just a manager, but I soon became the supervisor, and finally, it didn't take long before the Williams brothers wanted out. And so I bought them out about 1970, 69 it was, signed all the papers. 1969, bought the Williams out. So then I owned half of Waipopo along with the Mackay brothers. And then, of course, farming became like it always has been. It has its ups and downs. In those days, wool was the thing that paid the money and paid the bills. Lambs and cattle went too bad, and then we had the rural downturn. We had interest rates go up to 23%, I think they went up to. And basically, Mary Lou and I more or less stopped everything, just existed. Put the discs away and stopped all the development. Couldn't afford to top dress, and we just kept the place going and producing for about 3 or 4 years until things caught up, and then interest rates came back down again with a big rush. And in that time, the Mackay brothers were wanting their money out of farming, mainly because farming didn't seem to be going terribly well and they were getting older. So one by one, they said, "Would you buy my share?" And Mary Lou and I were struggling, but we kept it going. The property was too good a place to subdivide, so I was mortgaged up to the eyeballs with help from Mary Lou as well. We stayed there and farmed it. Most of the time I had one tractor driver, a fellow called Ken Nicholas, who had been a British merchant seaman, and he had jumped ship, going to South America, and ended up in New Zealand, and the two of us kept the place going for a year or two. I had a number of very good young men, shepherds, who worked for me. Two of them had been cadets at Smedley, and came and I said, "You can work for me as shepherds, you won't get the manager's job, but you can work for me no less than 1 year, no more than 2 years, and then you can move on." And they both turned out to be very successful farmers in their own right. Now, in the end, the Mackay family were out of Waipopo, and that's when Mary Lou and I decided to build a new house on Waipopo, which is still there today. We're both very lucky that we had a son who wanted to be a farmer, and he went off to learn his farming from a number of different farmers, but he'd been to Lincoln University as well and been on a trip overseas and came back, and so I was very lucky to have a son that wanted to go farming. In the meantime, of course, all those years I call the hard, difficult years, the children were growing up. We had Kirsty and Susan and Richard in that order. And Kirsty and Suze went off to Woodford, and Richard went after Hereworth down to Christ College. So we had all the kids boarding at a certain stage, and that was a fairly big hurdle to handle. But we seemed to get by, and everyone did well at school, did very well indeed, and went off to university. What do you say about the girls too? It's really about my life and my farming life. And it's,
well, they're all part of a family.
Yeah, it's like an old gramophone getting old brain working. So the girls did very well at Woodford, went off down to university and basically did very well there and went off into the big wide world like they all do. Kirsty finally got married to Warren Barclay, who is one of the sons of Ross Barclay from Gisborne, and basically she now lives in Auckland. Suze went off to university, did a marine biology degree, and she, you know, all our family were good skiers, and that used to have, you know, quite a lot of sport and skiing and so on, and they all do, very much involved in skiing. Suze is such a keen skier, she ended up eventually, after doing a lot of interesting work, computer programs and that sort of thing, she ended up in Oakuni, and she met Murray Brown, and she now has my only granddaughter, Coco, and her older brother, Rupert Brown. And so Susan and Murray and the two kids lived in Oakuni for some time, and they're now living back in Havelock North. Kirsty married Warren Barclay. They started off in Wellington, but soon went to Auckland. And, of course, four boys in their family. So as time goes on, the boys all go through school, Auckland Grammar, and then came out the other end as university students. Where we are today is Tourism University, and one of them, the third son, Ben, got into a lot of trampolining and finally got into skiing, shall we say, freestyle skiing. He became very proficient at ski jumping or whatever. They go down the mountain and hit up ski jump and do several somersaults and come back backwards. There's so many different things he can do. Just practiced at it, Ben, for years, and he's now part of the New Zealand ski team as a 15-year-old, currently in the United States, doing very well at that. We wish him well. Anyway, then Richard, of course, up on the farm, he was married to Nadine Barker, a Tauranga girl, and they have been up there for a long time, and they now have two sons. Young Jasper is, as we speak, second year at Linda's farm, and he's a rower, and his younger brother, Henry, that famous name Henry Williams, he's a student at Tamata Primary. He seems to be quite an athlete at the moment, following probably after his mother, Nadine, who's a bit of a runner. She runs half marathons and that sort of thing. So I'm very lucky to be the grandfather of seven grandsons and one granddaughter, and they all live in the North Island. Unlike so many of my friends whose family now live in Europe or Australia, and they're not seeing as much as they should of their grandchildren. So that more or less gets me up to the modern day. It more or less tells you how I got into Waipopo for a start.
Well, that was a really big challenge for a young man to go there with no people on it.
Oh, well, I was lucky I'd been to big places like Mangahani, and it wasn't too big for me.
Yeah.
It was like getting around only a quarter of Mangahani, for example.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Some of the big lands and survey blocks I worked on.
Have you been back to Mangahani?
Yeah, oh, quite often, yeah.
It's a beautiful station, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a young man's block of land, and of course it's now not the same big block, because the Kelly block has been bought by Plimmer, I think, from Wellington, and the other part, who the hell owns that now, I'm not sure. But it was all one block, and we were there. And I can remember my second year I was there, I told to go out, one or two shepherds would go out there, and we'd camp the winter out in this bloody old worry in the Kelly block. Snow, and geez, it was cold, but it was bloody good, because you'd get up, and yeah, they were always bloody good food. We had sort of half-bred merinos up there, and you'd kill them up in a wooden fire, you know, so you'd damp the fire down, the last man out, and we'd put a great big roast in the bloody oven and damp the fire down, and that was about 7 o'clock in the morning, bloody frost outside and all the rest of it, or snow or whatever, and you'd be out all day, and you'd come back, and the fire had been sort of just burning away, and that roast would have been absolutely perfect. Yeah. And we had this fella, Stan Diggis, who was one of those Polish immigrants. That's part of my life, really. You know the Kepka family, Richard Kepka? Yeah, well, you see, Ian built the Waipopo house up there. I should mention something about that.
Yes, you should, because Ian was...
Well, her name was Janet, wasn't it? Yeah. Is she still alive?
No.
Well, you see, all those Polish immigrants came out during the war, and I've spoken to Richard about it and Ian about it a lot, and geez, it was a bloody tough life. When the Germans came into Poland and killed everybody, and Ian was one of quite a large number of boys that were sent out to Russia. He lived in a sort of a prisoner of war camp, and, you know, he said one day they found a potato that was cooked and it had fallen out the pot or something. And he and his mate shared this one potato, you know, starving little piggers. And then there was a period of time when the Shah of Persia in those days was down there in Persia, and they were sent down to Persia. And then Canada, Australia and New Zealand came in and said, look, there's something like 15,000 of these kids, boys and girls, and we've got to do something about it. And so they more or less went, you know, 5,000 each to Canada, New Zealand and Australia. And so this bloke, Stan Diggis, D-Y-G-Y-S, Stan Diggis ended up on Angahani. And you could hardly understand him, the accents, all that, just like Ian was when he was a kid. And by the time Richard comes along, his English was much better, you know, and he's a real Kiwi. And geez, they've been an asset, those blokes. Immigrants, they've all got great work ethics and that, but Stan was a rough bastard. But anything goes, you know, and I remember the boss saying, right, we're going to footlot all of yous, you know, and he'd get in there, and he was a tractor driver, but it was all hands to deck, you know, and he dragged his bloody yous over the board and foot rot. It's a prick of a job. That's what he had to do in those days. Oh, now we need to dig the shit from underneath the wool shed, you see. And Stan to get in there, bare feet, just shorts, no shirt, covered in shit from head to foot. And we'd all be in there, you know, doing our bit, and getting the shit out. And every second word was a swear word, you know. But a bloody good Kiwi, you know. Yeah. And when I got there, the station bought a D4C Caterpillar tractor. And it was the first one I'd seen that had the forward and reverse gear on it. Bloody good tractor, it really was. And brand spanking new. And anyway, he was a tractor driver. He had out on his Kelly's block, and he'd drive it all the time. He wasn't doing agricultural work. He'd be building dams. And he built this dam, I suppose it was probably May, and he was building this dam. And one of the big winter storms came in. He'd been working all day, and he left it parked on the dam wall, unfortunately. And anyway, there's such a hell of a storm, a new dam, and the dam wall sort of half collapsed, and the tractor went in sideways, so it was on the dam side, and it completely flooded it. And it had to be dragged out by some heavy machinery and taken down to Palmerston North and cleaned out. Yeah, it was all right, yeah.
They were so much more powerful than the D4C was.
Yeah, yeah, well, you see, I've had a D4C up in Waipopo for about 10 years now or more. It was about third hand, I think, and the council used to own it. But anyway, so I got it retracked, and it's been a hell of a good tractor. But I was the bulldozer driver, because I remember the top pressing pilot, Ken Johnson, coming up. Oh, Jesus, Pete, he's got this bloody new tractor. Level all the hills up with that, mate, you know. And, well, that's a bit of an understatement. But, basically, if you get some other bugger on the tractor, you know, well, he spends far too long on it anyway. And it costs a lot of money to run. But having done all the stock work and see where the stock go, I knew where the crossings should be. And I put a lot of culverts in, a lot of bridges and a lot of tracks. And every so often you'd get a cyclone bowler type of thing come along. And, man, there's nothing like that bloody big tractor to push the bloody slips out of the way. I don't know what else we can talk about.
We're going to say something about Ian Kepka, because he built the first house.
Just trying to think of the year. It was mid-1970s we built this house, Okay. Merlo and I had been on the farm for about 7 years on Waipopo, living in what had been the homestead at Waipopo. In actual fact, was a house that had been built, and it started off with a removed floor, a fireplace, and pit saw and timber. But when it got to the roof, it didn't have long-run iron. It had old oil drums from the farm sent down to be corrugated and sent back up, and very short, it was a fairly flat roof, so every time you got a storm, the storm would blow the rain underneath all the joints, and it was leaking all over the place. And Merlu really put up with a lot living in that house for 7 years, and we decided to build a new one. And so our architect was John Scott, and young Jacob was a boy in those days. He came up and had a bit of a look, and basically Ian Kepka was the builder. And Ian came all the way from Taradale, and a great gang of builders, and they built this lovely new home for us about 1972 from memory. And that made Mary Lou's life, made my life. It was an asset to the station, and it's still a beautiful home now being lived in by Richard and Nadine and their two boys. But I just wanted to say what a great builder Ian Kepka was. Then, funnily enough, when Mary Lou and I finally left Waipoupou and came down to Havelock North, we built a house in Hikinui Drive, number 58, and John Scott's understudy, you would have known him too because he lived at Haumoana. Steve McGavick, yeah.
Steve's still alive?
No, he died. I went to his funeral about a year ago. Died far too young. So funny enough, we decided to build it, 58 Hikinui Drive, and Steve and Jacob Scott came up and had a look at the site. And so we built this house with Ian Kepka's son, Richard Kepka, who carried on in his father's footsteps. And they did a wonderful job building a house at 58 Hikinui Drive for us. And it's still got some characteristics of the John Scott design that you can see. But just wanted to say what a great part of our lives the Kepka family and John Scott had put into building for us, designing and building.
Think what it was like in the early 1800s when it took 6 months to walk from Paihia to Hawke's Bay or to Wellington, or to sail the boat from Paihia down the west coast. Imagine they would have come down the west coast, would they?
To go to school in the old days. I think they came up the east coast actually. They used to go to Littleton and then Wellington and then Napier and then Brisbane. But I know Jack Williams, he's got a book that I've read. He only came home from Christ College once a year. They left school and they decided to go through Cook Strait and up the west coast, and there was such a hell of a storm. Blew them right past the Manukau Harbour and ended up in bloody Kai Tai or somewhere. Turned around and come all the way back. Half the holidays are all over before he got back home, but that's what happened in those days. Yeah.
During this period of farming and doing all of this development work, you also had an interest in golf. When did that start?
Oh, yeah, right. Well, that's a good point. When Mary Lou finished having family, really, funny enough, she was always a good golfer because her mother had taken her aside as a 16-year-old and said, come on, you're going to come and play golf at Bridge Park. And her mother, Phyllis, had played a bit of golf, but she used to take Mary Lou along, and Mary Lou learnt to hit a ball. And then, of course, at times she could put a bit of time into it as she grew up, and others she was having family and so on. But she joined the Hastings Golf Club and played a lot of golf there over the years and became a single figure handicap, played a lot with the Hastings ladies all around New Zealand and thoroughly enjoyed it. And she always said to me, why don't you play golf? Why don't you play golf, Pete? Of course, I was one of these farmers that could hardly spare any time off the farm. It would have taken me at least an hour to have to drive to Bridge Park. And I'd always been keen on flying, and I wanted to be a private pilot. And so when my father became ill, and I was about 30 years old, he wasn't a very well man as a result of the war and malaria and dengue fever and being in the Navy for a long time. I used to go down and see him, and maybe only see him for an hour, and then I'd think, well, I've come all the way to town, I'll go out to Bridge Power and have another flying lesson. And that all came together one day when my flying instructor, Herb Maxwell, said, okay, Peter, he said, that's good. He's doing a few circuits. He said, now I'm going to get out and go into the office and I want you to do 5 more circuits. And he got out of play and left me to it. And of course, he suddenly realised that you've got to bloody well remember everything he says. And so that was the start of my flying career. And I held a private pilot's licence for 15 years, during which time Mary Lou was usually my navigator, and we flew North Island, South Island, or landed, you know, right down there in all sorts of places on the west coast. And yeah, absolutely loved it. Wanaka, yeah, up and down the west coast.
So did you have your own plane or did you use the aeroplane?
No, those were the years where the interest rates were going up to 22%. And I thought, if I buy an aeroplane, I'll have to sell half the farm, or I'll never own half the farm, you know. And I gave it away. I thought, no, I'll just fly the Aero Club's plane. We had a top dressing pilot called Ken Johnston, and he used to fly the Fletchers. And I asked him what the best idea was for an aircraft hangar when I built my airstrip and super shed on the farm. And he said, look, there's only one thing to do. You build the doors on it. So when you can open the doors, you can fly your aeroplane straight out. He said, what you do is you have a boat winch at the end of the super shed, drag the plane in backwards and have it pointing straight out, and he said, all you've got to do is open the doors and fly out. I could have got to golf in 7 minutes.
You could have too.
Yeah, and that was the whole idea of flying down, 7 minutes instead of a full hour. But it never happened because of interest rates and up and down farming and so on. So I never actually owned my own aircraft. I just flew the aero clubs. Well, I actually won a navigation prize 1 year for flying a good 2 weeks holiday with Mary Lou, and we went right down all around the South Island and all the way back again and landed at Franz Josef of one of the strips. And the Franz Josef strip, he had to land in towards the mountains. Well, he had to land it first time, first go, otherwise, you never get out of it.
No second chance.
No, but it all worked well. So I loved my flying, and Mary Lou loved her golf, and she used to go on golfing holidays and so forth. And one day, when I got to 50, she said, well, Pete, you know, you're 50. How long are you going to fly for? And I said, well, I've been thinking about that myself too, because in the meantime, the costs of flying were going up. And then, of course, when you get to about 50, they turn around and say, oh, you're going to die tomorrow, so you've got to have, you know, your heart checked and ECGs and all these things. And all my good flying money was going into medicals. There's never anything wrong with me, but I thought, hell with it, you know. So I flew for 15 years and then went. And she said, that's marvellous. Now we can go play some golf together, which we did. She was great. She was a good golfer and a good mate. So, of course, that means that, unfortunately, she died a bit young. Mary Lou, she died when we'd been at Hickory Drive for probably 15 years. Mary Lou went to Auckland to have a knee operation, and she was fairly staunch. She wanted two knee operations at the one time because she thought that it'd hurry the job along a bit, but unfortunately it didn't work that way. Tragically, she died in Auckland having this double knee operation at the age of 67, which was far too young and totally unexpected. So, that was tragic. Bugger, can't think, Frank. Once I started getting established down in Havelock North and retired, Mary Lou and I were able to have some very good holidays overseas in which we played quite a lot of golf together, travelled around several different countries. We were very, very fortunate to have a family that were doing well for themselves, and we were able to get away and have holidays, and it was really a great part of our life, having raised three kids and basically get out there and have a good time together before she died. Since then, well, I was in Hickory Drive, I suppose, 3 or 4 years, and decided that it was too big for me. So I moved down, what's it now, 2019. In the middle of 2018, I managed to buy Bray Place, which was just a brand new apartment overlooking Anderson Park. Anderson Park was in such a good locality. So I sold Hickory Drive and moved down here, and now leading a full retirement life with not too much garden. Playing a lot of golf, a lot of tennis, getting on with life as an 80-year-old, and that's where we are today.
Coming back to Maraetotra, you had a lot of good friends in that area.
Oh, yes. Well, when we first went up there, of course, we were the youngest in the area, and we were so well looked after by the oldest. We're next-door neighbours to Gordon and Elaine Blackmore, who lived up Tower Road. And then further up was Chris McGillivray, and then down the road was John and Faye Palmer. And I can remember numerous occasions being invited to their places for various functions, and I can remember John Palmer ringing me up and saying, oh, Peter, bring Mary Lou down. And they had, I think it was the 100th anniversary of the Angus Association, something like that, and they held it at the Angus Inn, and I've never been to a party like it. Not that we were Angus, we're Hereford, but they were just so nice to us, looking at the youngest people in the district. So I remember that was a huge party. But they welcomed us, all those three families, with open arms. And then just down the road, of course, was Tony Parker. And Tony and Robbie had children exactly the same age as my daughters. And we all got together for many parties and many occasions in the district, and life went on. And in those days, of course, the road was very much a shingle road all the way up from Maraetotra School. The Maraetotra School is worth remembering in the fact that it went up and down in numbers the way cycles of families went, really. And sometimes some families' children grew up and moved on, and younger ones came in. And I can remember Shirley Wood was chairman, I was secretary, I think, of the school in our heyday when our kids were there. And the numbers went from, say, 15 kids up to 23 kids, and they built a second classroom on, and it was going famously. And all of a sudden, the cycle went the other way and children left.
Shipments left.
And then, of course, the new classroom was hardly ever used. And then the real downturn came when the farmers had sold the house at the front gate sort of thing. And who came and lived in it? Lifestylers. So the lifestylers came and lived in it. And they're not the sort of person that's going to help you with your nagging and your fencing and your shearing. And so the school deteriorated to the extent that the farmers owned a school bus store, but basically the school committee was run by people from out of the district. And I don't want to say too much more about that, except the school finally closed over a ridiculous, I don't know where I should say this, but the country was going through what I think at the moment is the worst thing, all this PC rubbish that goes on these days. So they had a thing called a noise control officer. And the guy that was running the school was a headmaster who lived in the house, and all the area around the school was farming. And basically, they used to use Selby Palmer's TRTP strip for top dressing. And one Sunday morning, the Fletcher comes down and top dresses all around the school, and the schoolmaster says, "This is not good enough," rings up the noise control officer. The noise control officer comes up and he says, "No, this is not good enough. We'll go straight up to..." "Yeah, go straight up to Tiaratipi and see the pilot." And he says, "No more flying." He said, "That's it. Too much noise, you know." So there was something like 150 ton of fertilizer sitting in Selby Palmer's shed, and suddenly no more flying. And what happened to the super? It went hard out of the concrete, you know. And so the rest of the farmers couldn't get their top dressing done. A hell of an argument. Selby Palmer couldn't get his own top dressing done because of all this other fertilizer still in the bin. And this just goes to show all this PC sort of rubbish that's going on these days. It's just holding the country to ransom. That's the sort of thing that happens.
Ridiculous.
So that takes care of... Well, we had some good times in those days.
You were part of the National Party too?
Well, yes, if you want to bring politics into it. I think we all were. Politics comes into it, I think, definitely. I was a National Party supporter. Basically, I didn't want to get into anything too serious with it, but we used to have National Party meetings or pay a sub, that sort of thing, very strong. Funny enough, at Waipoupo, when I went there, there was a straight line boundary between the old Waimarama station and Te Apiti station, and the boundary was set on the east coast by the Maori tribes, the Waimarama tribe and the Maori tribe that lived down at Karakau Beach, and their boundary was Red Island. Red Island sort of halfway down the coast there. So there was a straight line from Red Island due west up to Te Aratipi Trig, which is the northern side of Waipoupo, 2,000 feet, and then further west to Ngā Puke Trig, which is still on Waipoupo, 1,850 feet. And so that boundary still exists today, and everything south of that was in Kiwi Keith Holyoake's electorate called Paiatua. And Kiwi Keith wouldn't have a clue where Waipoupo was, because even when we built our house and we had to get building consents and inspect the site, the people from the council had to come all the way up from Dannevirke, and they'd drive up to Hastings. Where the hell's... No, we don't know where this is. No one ever came to our place to check it all out, because we're in the wrong county. Anyway, I always wanted to be part of Hawke's Bay, because that's where all our services came from. John Renton was the one that solved the problem. He said, "Pete, there's only one thing you can do, and that is wait until somebody else on that boundary wants to sell and get in the other county." And eventually did happen, because that boundary more or less carried on way further west, you know. And so suddenly somebody did that, and we sort of made an application to the council that we should go from Paiatua electorate into Hawke's Bay County, and that actually happened. And our rates went up, of course, but at least we could ring up the council and say, "Look, we want something done to the road," or, yeah, and that's how it worked. So, yeah, Paiatua electorate, we used to vote for it, and I knew Kiwi Keith came from Paiatua, but honestly, it was ridiculous. But now we've got Lawrence Yule, a local man, and you know, I can really talk to somebody in our electorate that we can have something done. That's enough of politics.
Well, now, just coming back to your stock, you had one problem that Hawke's Bay people didn't have. You had rainfall. You had grass that grew all year round.
Yeah, well, I can talk till the cows come home about all that. Basically, when I came to Waipoupo, it was all part of Te Apiti Station, and funnily enough, it became Waipoupo in 1914. That's when the road was built from the Havelock side up, and it finally got up to the Te Apiti boundary. And so the owners at the time, the Sunderland family, decided that Waipoupo should be run as a separate block of land, simply because it had access to Havelock. and that road was completed in 1914, which, you know, is the beginning of the First World War. And it was definitely known by the shepherds from Te Apiti that happened to be put up on Waipopo, which was considered to be the cold, hard block of land up there, always wet and rainy. They used to ride a pack horse down to Havelock North and fill it up with beer. Take it back up. And they had a worry on Waipopo, and the paddock was called Old Worry. It still is called Old Worry. Not a very big paddock, but it's where their worry was. And if you dig a post hole anywhere in that paddock, you can guarantee to strike a bloody bit of glass coming up. Yeah, so that was interesting. But it meant that Waipopo was only 3/4 of an hour away from town, whereas Te Apiti, by road from Havelock, was miles away. That was their big problem. People often wonder why it was called Waipopo. And I've asked Maori, we've had Maori workers on the place and so on. And the translation, why means water, but poa poa could be anything from heavy rain to everlasting mist, anything in between. And so the higher you got, there was quite a significant increase in rainfall from where the homestead was up to where the bush at the top was, another 300, 400 feet higher, another 15 inches of rain a year, you know. But don't worry, we've had some droughts too. The whole property goes brown, but we did have... Our biggest asset was having springs that bubbled up. There's one spring overlooking the ocean at the top of Te Apiti. It was like a 4-inch pipe of water that's coming out all the time. You know, so at 1,850 feet, where does that come from? Taupo is only 1,250, and Kwakamwan is 2,000, but it's a long way away. And I reckon the water comes from the Ruhinis, and it follows the limestone layer right under the Hautalanga Plains and up the other side. And it still goes. Some years it's better than others, but it hasn't changed, and I don't think the climate's changed. We started off in the very wet years when I was there. We had 120 inches a year, and I can remember poor old Mary Lou living in this old homestead where you'd open the kitchen door and the rats would be scuttling from one cupboard to the next. She lay in the bath and looked up, and she could see the rats jumping across between the cracks in the jib board. It wasn't funny. It was horrible. For 7 years we lived in that house. And no matter what we did to it, we did quite a lot to make it better, like re-roofed it and all the rest of it, but it was still pretty old and not in a good position.
I always remember the first time I went up there. I'd never seen hay like it.
No, you're quite right. Well, those were the wet years. And you see, we had 120 inches more than once. And to get things like the washing done, you know, I've seen 2 months solid where it didn't have one day where you could dry clothes. And so the kitchen would have the wooden fire going all day, and you had the thing on a pulley that pulled the ceiling. And it was hard on the wives as well as on the staff. And just to get any major operation done, like weaning calves or forget about making hay. But, you know, those years have fluctuated, and now it seems to have gone down to probably the lowest point at Waipopo would be 60 inches a year.
Yes.
But now it's going back up again, and they can call it what they like. They can call it global warming or global cooling.
It's normal fluctuations.
It's fluctuations, yeah. So you've got to learn to live with it. But to get back to the stock, because we were part of Te Apiti, in those days, old Richard Sunderland used to have a Romney stud, and Waipopo, he had the progeny of Te Apiti from Dick Sunderland's Romney stud, and they were like that when I came, and then I didn't think they were performing too well, so I stuck to Romney's because Romney's producing good wool. Basically, stuck to Romney's, and I went down to Jock Duncan's for a start, bought some rams from down there, but I think the transition height from more or less sea level right up to the top of Waipopo, they didn't seem to move that well. And then Tony Parker came along, and he got right into it in a big way. And so I could go buy rams and be back home by morning smoke. Crikey. Instead of going all the way to the Wairarapa and buying rams down there from somebody, and the stock agent would want to go to the pub all the way home and that sort of thing. Basically, I stuck with Tony for a long time, very successful. And then I had a stock agent called Don Shaw, who worked to Richmond's, and Don was a big help to me. I'd known Don for years anyway. When I was at Mangahani, he used to live up there as a stock agent and around Taihape. And so he came up, and after a couple of years or so, he said, Peter, he said, these sheep aren't that big. You could put a bit of bone into them by going somewhere else, and why don't you have a go? And then Mount Linton down in Southland were doing very well with their Romneys, and, you know, new people down there and seen some of the sheep, and I decided I'd go down there for 2 or 3 years and buy their rams. Well, and I remember Don Shaw coming up after 5 years of this. And Peter said, I can't believe these are the same bloody sheep, you know. They're much bigger and, you know. Tony Parker's background of Grand Dams and all the performance of the background. So I had Tony Parker's progeny, but made a bit bigger by Mount Linton. And I've got to say, the highlight of my farming was nothing to do with me. It was the circumstances of the time where wool was pretty good money. It was $6 a kilogram. And went out docking one year. I always had my transistor radio, and at lunchtime I'd turn on the news and the weather and have lunch with a docking gang. And along came the news saying, live exports to Saudi Arabia, no tails. At least leave the tails on, yeah, the bull's in. Yeah. And I thought to myself, what the hell are we docking for? But being a breeder myself, you've got to cut the tails off. In those days they used to dock everything, and so they were all wethers, and they started off with wethers, and I had these wethers that were going live export, $40-$45. Having had 6 kilograms of wool shorn twice a year at $6 a kilogram, and I remember plainly that one of the shearers leaning over the Catston pen door, and he said, look at one of these wethers, you know, and they're a big sheep. Jeez, boss buggers are like shearing a 40-gallon drum, you know. And they'd drag it out. But once you set him on his ass, you'd almost see the smile on the sheep's face. It would just sit there, and the shearer would go round them and out the porthole. And then nothing to do to them, you know. I didn't even drench them. Mm. I cut down my new numbers and basically just went as many wethers as I could. And so I used to wean the lambs. And when I sexed the lambs, I'd take all the male lambs that were really good, maybe 1,000 lambs, and wouldn't let Don Shaw even take a look at them. He never even knew they were there, because he would take us back to the works and cut the heads off. And I'd think, no, I'm going to keep them as wethers. And, well, I think after about 3 or 4 years, I had 3- and 4-year-old wethers that were growing so much wool, and you didn't have to do anything to them. They never even got fly strikes. Yeah. Put them out in the back paddock, and, you know, one bark of the dogs and they're up and back home in no time at all, jump all the creeks. The best farming I ever did. But then, of course, along comes all the animal rights people, and they say, oh, no, no, this is no good. You can't sell sheep to Saudi Arabia, and they all die on the ship and all the rest of it. But I made more money those years. The whole story was myself and one man, but it was just easier farming. And such a pleasant way of farming, because, you know, the shearing gang loved it. And out goes the wool bales on the truck, and yeah, we made money.
Which was the house that burnt down?
Can we just stick to the stock?
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, and anyway, we haven't mentioned cattle, you see.
No.
So sheep was always the Romney when I was there, and the price of wool went down and down and down. Mm. Such a sad thing, because it's a great product. And then I can remember the price of lambs going down to about $10 a lamb. People these days wouldn't have a clue. $10 a lamb's nothing, really. And it was still wool that was paying some of the bills. And then it got down to, in those days we had 80 million sheep, and now we've got, what, 40 million or less, 20 million. And so that's one of the reasons. It's always been a land use thing. But Waipaupo is definitely a stock place, and, you know, I've had people come up and say, oh, you should plant the whole thing in pine trees, you know, to hell with that, I'm a stock man. And so with the rainfall, we realised that actually we can carry more cattle in relation to sheep. So it was always the Hereford. We'd always had the Hereford. We had a problem after I got there. The problem was dwarfism. And there was apparently some American bulls that were bloodlines that came in, and it was introduced through that, I think. The dwarfism really worried me, because every so often you'd see a calf that didn't look right, and it never grew, and it, no, it wasn't good. So my father, Paul Williams, he was a great friend of old Lou Harris, and Dad, you know, been in bull breeding all their lives, Shorthorn and whatever, the old man, he's, there's only one way you can sort that out, a crossbreed. And the thing is, what crossbreed you put over Hereford? You can either put Angus or Shorthorn. Mm. We tried Shorthorn for a start, and then we've had Angus and mucked around Simmental. My son Richard tried Simmental, and the thing is, it got rid of the dwarfism. And now we're back into Hereford again. And look, I'll tell you what, absolutely brilliant. And the other thing with Hereford was that Fred Chesterman was just down the road. And Fred was getting right underway when I was getting underway at Waipaupo.
Yeah.
I remember when he had his first bull sale, and he was in fear and trepidation of how the thing was going to go and all that. And I thought, well, you know, give him a go instead of going for miles away to buy bulls. Went down to Fred's first sale, and I bought lots, 3 bulls, lots 1 to 6. So I bought... He was, God, you're paying far too much money for those bloody bulls, you know. But, you know, I bought them. And Fred bought them up in his truck the next day, piece of cake. And then he spent about 2 hours down to bull sale instead of travelling for miles. And they moved well. up to my place. And they've gone from strength to strength, the Chesterman family, they really have. And so they've been great neighbours and great district people. And so I stuck with them and stuck with them, but I thought, well, you know, you've got to have a look at some other bulls too. So Bob Gunson used to breed bulls, Herefords and that. And yeah, so I bought quite a few from Bob over the years. So I've been at the Herefords for a long time, and after the dwarfism thing was solved, that was when my son came in, and he's played around with crossbreeding with Simmental. But he's now cut the farming down into, well, put it this way, when I was there, I was right into breeding ewes and breeding cows. Mm. And suddenly you'd get a drought, come out of the blue, and you've got to sell some stock. It's all breeding stock, you see. And my son thought, rightly, you've got to have some stock that's trading stock. You can get rid of it. And so he'd go out nearby, wean a steers from way out in the Buai somewhere that would move well, and keep them for a year, sometimes keep them for 2 years. Sell them when you wanted to. But it didn't matter if you had to sell them, they were just a trading stock, you know, and as long as you made a bit of money out of them. So he had a little bit less breeding stock on the place, but he could keep them through the droughts, you know, and so on. So we tried to farm with the way the seasons are, and the seasons, to me, are not terribly different from when I went there years ago. Well, I'm 80 now, and I don't think there's much difference when I was a little kid running around the beach 75 years ago. But we had dry seasons. I'm talking about the Gisborne Hill Country. Yes. But today, the headline news is all about terribly hot or terribly cold. Oh. Or there's a storm in Alabama. That's, they've always had bloody typhoons in some part of the world and hurricanes and others. And our country is no different. We've had some terrible storms. Now, when I went up to Waipopo and walked along, this was when I first went there, and I walked right round the boundary, you know. You got up the top of Waipopo and there's a beautiful block of 100 acres of bush. And on Chester Wall's side, there were all these bloody great big rimu trees that had dropped, obviously the same way, from the southerly, and it dropped into Chester Wall's place. Smashed the fence just before I... This was 1926, all these came down. And I thought, what the hell happened in 1926? Well, just another huge storm. They're like a cyclone bowler type of thing. And I asked old Cecil, clearly remember Cecil telling me that, well, we had a drought, and then we had this hell of a rain, sort of a northeasterly tropical depression come down, probably 20 inches in 20 days sort of thing, which we've had before and had after. And then this monstrous southerly came, and all the trees were totally, the roots were wet, and it pushed them over. But that just happened, you know, and if that happened again next year, some prick would get up and say, oh, with climate change, you know, it's terrible. There's going to be a disaster in a few years' time. This carries on.
Another property you made mention of earlier, that Mount Linton.
Yes.
Isn't that a beautiful station? Southland's got some great country, hasn't it?
Yeah, but what was underneath some of that country? Bloody coal mine. Coal, yeah. But in those days they were allowed to mine it, weren't they? And yet, you know, they're still mining some of our best coal in New Zealand and sending it to India. So what's that tell you?
Well, what else have you forgotten?
There's always going to be something.
Well, it's probably just about covered the field. So anyway, probably that will do for the present. Thank you, Peter, for this opportunity. Another page in Hawke's Bay history.